Good morning, good morning, good morning, and thank you for joining me on yet another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I am bringing you today some amazing guests. I know I say that every day, they're amazing guests, but today's guests are even more amazing than you've ever seen, because we've brought together, as always, five complete strangers, five people who have absolutely no idea about each other, what we're going to discuss, what the topic of the show is, and where it's going to go. Sounds like fun? It sounds like fun to me. So before I go ahead and introduce our guests, I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask you to do, and that is to go out and be an evangelist for the show, be an activist for the show. Go out and let people know the Roundtable Talk Show is live. So however you want to do that, whether it's sending a text, sending an email, sending an inbox, heck, send a carrier pigeon. I don't care, but let people know the Roundtable Talk Show is live, because friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. So while you're doing that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our very first guest. And she is here to help us and help our audience. She is a business and branding mentor. And she's also the author of Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, one of my favorite topics here on the Roundtable Talk Show. Being an entrepreneur, I want to introduce Ms. Charlene Waters. Good morning, Charlene. How are you?
Good morning, Sharifa. Thanks so much for having me on today. I'm doing great. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today.
You are so welcome. I'm excited to have you. I'm always interested in speaking with people who are interested in helping entrepreneurs. So before we talk about what you do, let's talk a little bit about you, your history, and how you got to this point.
Definitely. So I began undergrad as an English major. I've always loved to write. And then out of college, I got my first sales and marketing job, and I just grew this love of business. So from there, I went on to get my MBA. I was in higher ed. I've taught lots of workshops and courses. I got back out of higher ed because I thought I was too young for that at one point. Got more business experience back into marketing. Went on to get my PhD in marketing, and I actually developed a digital entrepreneurship MBA program. And I've most recently been working as a mentor to other entrepreneurs, and I am an expert on Entrepreneur Magazine's Ask an Expert platform. And I wrote a book called Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, which helps women develop their entrepreneurial mindset, because women sometimes need a little more help than men, just kind of finding their voice and trumpeting their accomplishments and really boosting that confidence that they need to be successful in business. And I'm really passionate about helping women. I'm a single mom, and women are the heads of their households now. They have to make a profit. So that's what I do currently. I'm out there training, consulting, and helping others.
That's wonderful. But did I hear you say you created an MBA program for entrepreneurs?
Yes, I did. I did. I'm out of that now. I got out of higher ed again, but that was my main focus for some time. And it was really a really rewarding process. I even got to go with a few women I mentored to Entrepreneur Elevator Pitch, where they pitched their businesses. So it's always amazing to work with people to help them develop their dreams.
Now, were you that little girl who had a lemonade stand? Like, when I speak to entrepreneurs, they always tend to have like this track record, like this history. They're always, you know, I talked to the guys. They were like, yeah, I used to mow lawns in high school, but it's always something in them.
Yes, definitely. I was always kind of coming up with my own things. I actually think that I invented Spanx before they came out. Big mistake there. And
I thank you.
I have two teenage daughters now, and they're out with brownie stands, lemonade stands. They're making earrings now. So I think it just runs in the family.
I think that's wonderful. But why entrepreneurs? I know you mentioned that women especially, we need that extra help, that extra push. But when you looked around at all the people, you know, you can help and you can serve, why was it so important to you to help entrepreneurs?
Because I think for women, you know, women have a tougher time in the corporate world. We've seen recently, a lot of them are the first to get laid off. They're not able to rise as quickly as men in many cases. So I think being an entrepreneur is a way for women to really take control over their own earnings and their own potential and really move forward. So I'm really passionate about that, helping women get out there and achieve everything that's possible for them.
Okay. So what now, what are you focused on? What is your main focus? Is it a book? Is it a website? Is it a platform? How are you focused on helping entrepreneurs today?
Yeah, so the book is coming out. It's actually available now on Amazon for pre-order. It'll be out in February. It's called Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur. It's about mindset shifts for women to help achieve success. And I'm also doing some mentoring, coaching, and training as well. So those are my main areas of focus. I also wrote a memoir, which I haven't released yet, about my life. My husband died when my children were just 2 and 4. So I became this single mom overnight. And just, I really want to help women who are in similar situations or anyone who's in a similar situation. The name of that book is Own Your Other. And I think many times in life, we find ourselves in situations where we end up somehow in a situation that we didn't want. I never said, hey, can't wait to be a single mom. But you know, sometimes it just happens. And we can't make the most of those situations until we really own them and accept them. And so my goal is just to help people who find themselves in those type of situations.
Okay, so we're going to look across the panel today, Charlene, and we're going to look at our guests and we're going to feel and for that entrepreneur spirit. And then when you have some questions or some comments or some advice for our guests, feel free to pop in there. Now I'm going to come right back to you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. And she is also amazing. She is the author of Mother Behold Thy Son. Her focus is the power of mothers who change the world. Miss Francie Mandeya. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Sharifa, for having me. Thank you everyone on the panel. What should I talk about? My book? Well,
what would you like to talk about? It's Thursday. We can discuss anything you want.
Let me talk with something that you don't know. Just listen. Boroi, makadini salivonani, linjani, dimacheroni, mahuachimi, muriwapi here. Boroi, makadini salivonani, linjani, dimacheroni, mahuachimi, muriwapi here. Bonjour, hello, can we be? Bonjour, hello, can we be? Boroi, makadini, salivonani, linjani, dimacheroni, mapachini, muriwapi, here.
Yes. I tell you, the roundtable talk show, you never know what's going to happen. I was definitely not expecting that. Talk to us. Talk to me.
That's what I'm playing. I am from Zimbabwe. So that's called Mbira. It's a traditional instrument by our ancestors over 1,000 years ago. This, before I'm an author, this is my go-to. Mm-hmm. I started playing in 2007 by some strange accident. I think the ancestors really wanted me to own it, and I didn't know it wasn't me that I could play and let alone sing in front of people. I wasn't one to sing before people, but my kids got me into this. I don't know. I'm the one that's left playing the instrument and left with the music, but I sing to heal myself. I sing to heal other people. And I know that this instrument is therapeutic because I get the testimonies back to me that people who have lost their children, who are in emotional turmoil, heal just by listening, by embracing this instrument. So there was a time in my life.
I know you lifted my spirits this morning. I got to dance. I got to move. I mean, that felt really good. I liked it. Francie, hold on for 1 minute because I want to bring in some of our other guests, but I'm going to come back to you because we definitely have to discuss Mother Behold Thy Son as well as the power of mothers, which is something that Charlene spoke about as well. Mm-hmm. But We won't negate the power of dads and fathers and men in our life, because we have a pretty balanced show today. So mm-hmm. I want to introduce mm-hmm. our next guest, Mr. Mark Laffelholz. Mm-hmm. He is an author as well, and he is always interested in writing about 1940s style noir mystery series of books. Mark, are you going to play for us as well? Because now I'm expecting, you know, I'm expecting some music, some dance.
Well, you know, she has raised the bar very high. I don't think I can measure up to that.
I need something. I need a jump, a song.
That was beautiful. I enjoyed that a lot. I have been writing these books for about 10 years. They're really they're based on the old books by like Raymond Chandler. Philip Marlowe was his private eye. Dashiell Hammett, everybody knows about the Maltese Falcon. His character was Sam Spade, and Mickey Spillane had a hero named Mike Hammer. My guy is named Oscar Jade, and he lives in Miami Beach in 1941. These books are designed to be just like watching an old movie that you eat some popcorn and have some fun. And it's mysteries, basically mysteries with get a little action at the end for the kids, you know, some car chases, gunfights, femme fatales, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I have a comment. I was going in a different direction. This is what happens in my life. But Amy Trout Hughes says, Mark, you and I are inspired by the same first book. Just jumped on Amazon to pick up your books. Philip Marlowe and James Bond were my first two crushes. Yep, I'm odd like that. So Amy says she enjoyed it. She's picking up a copy of your book now. So that's
fantastic. Yeah, I started reading the old Ian Fleming James Bond books when I was 11 years old. The first one I read was called On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I was so excited by the way Fleming wrote, and everybody's familiar with James Bond, the movie character. The books were written starting in 1953, so there's a very different kind of vibe than the. And I love the movies. Such a different, it's, you know, Cold War spy stuff, and I was just very inspired by the way he could put a sentence together. Ian Fleming was a British newspaper man. He was a journalist primarily, and I really learned my style from him. He's very economical, you know, he does not overwrite, straight to the point, and is not afraid to be a little sensational and escapist. I like escapism. I like to just lose myself in whatever world I'm writing, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to be in a certain mood or a certain place in order for you to write?
Most definitely. If you write anything like this, any kind of like action thrillers, I call these mystery action thrillers, I'm kind of always channeling my inner 13-year-old. You know, it's what I think about what would be the most fun and interesting and exciting thing I can write. And that's how I tend to do it. I approach it from a standpoint of joy. I really enjoy the writing process. I enjoy listening to my characters talk. I'm often complimented on my dialogue. I literally just listen to my characters and listen to what they say. I don't feel like I'm writing it necessarily. I'm channeling it from somewhere.
To me,
it's almost like magic.
It sounds like magic, but how about when you do like the gunfights and all these different scenes, you just see those in your mind or you've experienced them. How do you make that so real?
I do. And I sometimes act it out to a degree myself. My editor, when I wrote the first book, my first book was called Blood and Ashes. Mm-hmm. And my editor said that she was running around her house with a gun, trying to see what I was doing as she was editing me. So it's it's definitely part of the process. You really do have to channel your inner adolescent.
So when she was editing, did she come back and say that angle was wrong? There's no way you would have got that shot around the corner. I tried it. It didn't work.
No, she actually was very complimentary. She goes, you know, I, after I did it, I saw what you're doing. And, you know, so it worked, so.
Okay, well, that's what matters, Mark. So I'm going to come back to you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. He is the owner of GP Hospitality Partners, LLC, which is a full-service restaurant and hospitality consulting firm, Mr. Greg Provence. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Sharifa. Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome. But now you know there's a high cost to entry. I need a song, a dance, a joke, a rap, something.
You know, I got nothing this morning. I got nothing, but I can tell you this, you know, Mark, I don't have to channel any inner adolescent. It's right there, man, all the time. I'm like a kid for sure.
Yeah, how can you be a kid and own a hospitality firm? Like, how does that even work?
It's a requirement for sure. You know, you got to see things through the eyes of a child for sure. You know, my past is kind of sordid. I actually come from the entertainment business. I spent a lot of years as a professional actor and musician, and ended up in Los Angeles. I'm from the East Coast originally, Virginia Beach, Virginia. I grew up in, and moved to New York City in the mid-90s. And then landed in Los Angeles right after 9/11. And it was then that I started to kind of take the restaurant business more seriously as a career, started sprouting a family, and realizing that, you know, the acting business wasn't always, you know, so supportive to, you know, support those little kids that I was sprouting. So as I dove deep into different levels of management and so forth, I started to realize, you know, I really had that entrepreneurial bug. Charlene, you'll appreciate that. It was always something that was kind of knocking at the door. And I always knew I wanted to do something of my own, but I didn't necessarily want to just go run out and open a restaurant, because it was a little risky at the time, in my view. So I started to reach out kind of on the side and start to consult for businesses around town and see if I could apply some of the skills and understanding that I'd learned over the years to help other people to grow. And what I found was that after years and years of trading a lot of time for money, I could start trading a little of this for money and growth, and it started to work. And so that's where GP Hospitality Partners was born. And then last year, just before COVID, I officially launched the business and went out into explore my partnerships and really kind of kick things up a notch. And it's been great. It's been an amazing, you know, way of being. It allows me to help a lot more people than just the one, you know, business that I'm sort of running. And it's just a great way to work. So I really... I'm really, really excited. I also, I did write a book. It's not out yet. It's actually going to be self-published, and I'm still kind of putting the finishing touches on it, but it's called Butts in Seats: How to Create Raving Fans Who Come Back Again and Again. And it's specifically geared towards restaurant owners and people that really want to understand, especially in this COVID environment, how to, you know, grow and scale their restaurant business. And my approach is a little bit different than a lot of people. You know, a lot of consultants come in and they go straight to the numbers and it's all about the bottom line, where, you know, that is actually certainly important. You know, we need to look at all the systems and things that are, you know, happening, you know, within the business. But for me, it's all about growing cultures and growing people, because if you grow the people, you grow the business. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really, really interested in, you know, how cultures work and how people are managing their cultures from the inside out of their business. And that's really the secret, I think, to the success, long-term success of any business, really, but certainly in the restaurant business and hospitality business, it's key.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and like you mentioned, in COVID, that is definitely the one industry. I mean, there are so many, but the restaurant industry definitely needs help and finding out ways to get more butts in seats. But it was interesting listening to you speak. I see the professionalism. I see the businessman. I see the entrepreneur. But when you came on, you're like, hey, I'm this big kid. You know, and I'm like, okay, I like that. But, and then you were an actor. One of the things that actors love is their ability to recreate themselves all the time. You know, one day I'm playing the judge. Tomorrow I'm playing the cop. And then the next day I'll be playing the drug dealer. You know, it's always
absolutely
phase. How do you bring that creativity into what you do now?
Oh, wow. You know, it's interesting. I've always said to my teams when, you know, when we're working, you know, we're working like we're on camera, right? Or we're on stage. I see the entire restaurant team as sort of a cast in a play, right? So the servers are the actors, and the chefs are the great set designers, and, you know, the hosts are the, you know, the MCs, and, you know, all of those elements have to come together in a beautiful sort of harmony and symphony to make things work, to give an amazing guest experience. And, you know, I've often said too, you know, as part of, you know, what our servers do as steps of service and the service that we give to our guests, it's all about, you know, kind of learning those lines, understanding them, but then living them, right? It's not just about saying the words. It's about really living the spirit of what we're doing, because we're giving great experiences. We're not just serving food. And so it really, you know, I can kind of parlay it into a lot of things, but that's kind of, you know, what it means to me.
But that makes it fun. That makes it exciting. Greg, I'm going to come back to you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, because I'm pretty sure he's going to have some words of wisdom, some advice for the whole panel. And if not, you better make something up, because I'm introducing Mr. Peter Winso. He is a lead strategic advisor to several million-dollar multinational corporations, and he is a natural-born innovator. So he's going to share some of his thoughts today. Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Thanks for having me here.
Peter, you're doing that quiet, calm. You was talking to me backstage, Peter. What you got for me? You got a joke, a song?
Well, I was thinking, you know, save the best for last, but then I realized I don't have a dance act, I don't have anything, so it's not really the best for last, but hopefully I can make up in other ways.
I need a poem. I need something.
I don't really have anything.
He's like, I got nothing. I got nothing. This is when I try to see what I could finagle, you know what I mean?
Like, Francisca, what people came on with her instrument, I was like, okay, I'm dead. I'm out. What can I offer?
You can't offer that multi-million-dollar advice. You've been listening to the panel. What stands out to you? Who would you like to be like, look, let me tell you what I would do?
Well, I think, Greg, you probably do. We somewhat overlap in the sense that you probably help restaurants, you know, here in the U.S. market. What I do is I help restaurants explore the international market. So not too long ago, I worked with a fairly large, at least West Coast brand called Fatburger. And I brought them out to Asia and opened up to get several franchises to various countries. So I've worked with fairly large, both F&B and also fashion retail companies, and bringing them into other markets in Europe, be it in Africa or Southeast Asia. I lived in Southeast Asia for the last 8 years. I only moved back here to the United States about 2 years ago. But prior to that, I was pretty much in Southeast Asia, either in Manila or in Bangkok. I have homes in both places, and that's where I spent most of my time. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, helping businesses grow, not necessarily on a smaller scale, but a little bit once the businesses have, you know, gotten to a not substantial mass, but once they've gotten a little bit bigger, and then once they're ready to explore international markets, that's kind of where I help in and help them explore those opportunities.
That's wonderful. Greg, I know you're nodding. Any thoughts, any questions for Peter? He's like, yes, I'm glad I was on this show.
No, that's incredibly interesting, Peter. I mean, I can only imagine the challenges you got to face, you know, when translating an American business into a European or other, you know, world market. It must be incredibly challenging in a lot of ways, right?
It's super hard, because many times the supply chains are completely different. You can't get certain products, or the product completely different. I mean, it might be, you know, one thing, I used to live in Thailand a lot. And ginger out there is essentially the same as it is here, but the taste flavor profile of ginger in Thailand is extremely different than the ginger profile or taste profile here in the United States. Yet it's the same. So when you're making two, you know, dishes using ginger, the Thai version is going to taste, you know, quite different than the American version. And that's, of course, you know, quite hard when you're trying to bring out a very consistent product. Because again, I think you will agree with me is that the most important in the restaurant business is a consistent product. Either it's consistently bad or it's consistently good, but you want your customers always to know what to expect when they walk in that front door, right?
You know, I went to a McDonald's one time in Malta because I just wanted to taste what McDonald's tasted like in Malta, you know, and it was exactly the same.
Kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah, it was. It was like, okay, why did I do this? But, you know, it was actually interesting to me because, you know, how does it translate culturally, right? Like, you know, how do people in Malta feel about McDonald's to begin with? I've always been interested in how that would translate.
I think, like, for example, like burger chains are perfect. They're super popular here in the United States, and you'd think that it'd be popular, you know, everywhere. For example, again, in Thailand, Thai people don't really understand bread. So having something served between two slices of bread, it's kind of like, they don't quite get that. Yes. I know there's McDonald's there and it, you know, somewhat tastes the same. You know, they're having a hard time understanding this, you know, bread phenomenon with, you know, the American people.
I know sometimes things are different around the world. I want to go back to Francie, because we had the pleasure of, you know, your music. And then we had Amy Trout Hughes who commented. She was like, nobody else even gave us a haiku. Like, we can't even get a haiku from anybody else. But, and if anybody wants to volunteer, I'm ready for it. But Francie, let's talk about your book and what motivated you to write it.
Okay, my book, Mother Behold Thy Son, I will let you know that I have only one son. He turned 22 on October 15th, and I have two girls, 28 and 27. So I'm a mother of adults. I was born girl number three in a succession of girls back home, and there's eight siblings. So when I came into the world, they were not ready for another girl. So I was born into this energy of you are not enough, and I have a name, Ndaiziwe, and it means had I known. So I'm my mother's pain, my mother's protest against patriarchy, which was expecting her to produce an heir. And alas came this dark, darker than others, the rest of the family, girl who was not really like welcome. So I grew up with that in primary school, taking punches from boys because I was smarter than them and never understanding why they were beating me. In secondary school, boys groping me and violating my body. And when I tried to go to the school authorities to say, I am getting abused, they say boys will be boys. So I grew up in that environment. When I went to work, the manager groped me. When I was married, I was in a toxic environment, and it took me 12 years to extract myself from that toxic environment. So I wanted to know, I knew I deserved better, but I wanted to know what is it, why do people treat me this way? Why am I always at the mercy of people? And so as I became a mom, I started getting worried. Is my boy going to be like these men and boys that I've met in my life? What do I want to see as a mom when I'm done raising my own boy? I'll backtrack a bit. When my mother and father died, they were entrepreneurs in the rural area. They were rural business people. When they died, my brother, who's number four, took everything. And I was a single mom, student mom, struggling with my two babies. And just to be told you are nothing, like you're not getting anything from your father's wealth was a shocker, and it kind of rattled the whole family. So I had all these questions about being born a girl, being a woman. Everywhere I go, it seems there's this consistent treatment that makes me feel like I'm not enough, and that's so painful. So I wanted to change that for my own children, and I began to intentionally raise them as equals, And I told the girls, the two girls are older. The boy is the younger one. So I told them, you are equal. And it was coming from pain. Pain was my teacher. And so you saw me play the mbira. It came by accident, most strange, like I said, in my family. But I used that to channel some of my pain. And I used it to create a song, We Are Equal, Takayanzana, with my children. Because I was afraid, I'm saying it, that I'm going to raise them as equals. But how? So coincidentally, the mbira was there to help me co-create with my kids to say, you are equal. And it was the girls and the boys singing with me, sealing the commitment to say, I'm not going to have you experience what I went through. Because yes, in the end, for my boy child, he may seem like he's winning now, but in the end, with his relationships with women and girls, he is not going to win. You can only win when you treat other human beings as equals, authentically. Amen. So I wanted my son to know that joy from relating with girls and women as equals and be a present parent, be a compassionate man, and not fear that he's gonna be less of a man if he doesn't treat girls the way I was treated. Yes, so I wrote my story to teach my son to say, you don't do that. If mama felt that pain, if mama felt that way with the boys, then you don't want someone's daughter to feel like that because it's painful, it's wrong.
Yes, yes, like, yes. You are so passionate. Yes. I love the passion in your book and in your voice and in your message. Charlene, I would love for you to comment on what Francie had to say.
I love what she has to say. I think it's so important for many reasons, not only her experience, but also our children. We're worrying about them. And I know raising two girls, I don't have a son, of course, so I can't completely relate. But raising my girls on my own, I've always worried. The thing that I've held deep is that they don't have a dad. They're missing out. I feel so sorry for them. And I've asked them so many times and they tell me, you know, this is all we've ever known. It doesn't bother us. We see. And I always feel that kind of angst about it, but I see them talking about their futures. They're 13 and 15 and they have got it all planned. They are both going on. One wants to be an astrophysicist and one wants to be an orthodontist. They've got their schools picked. They've got everything. And so I think it's so important. And I'm so glad, Francie, that you're doing that. This work is wonderful because I think we all as parents set the example for our children. So if we're sending that message to treat everyone fairly, to be strong men and women, our children will get that. So I applaud you for your work there. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know, Greg, you mentioned your children were a part of why you decided to kind of go in a different direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the experience of having children, you know, I mean, it was all about me until then, you know, and sometimes still is, but my children are a big motivation for me in many ways. And I agree. I mean, I echo what Charlene said, Franzi, what you just shared was absolutely beautiful. And I think it's a lesson for anyone with or without children, to be able to, pass along that type of, attitude and that type of experience. If we have any, I think all of us have some type of experience where we've felt, denigrated or put down or something, whether it just be in school from a bully or something like that. And when you said pain is my teacher, that really resonated with me. I think the pain of any failure that we experience in life, if we can turn that around into a teaching moment, that's incredibly powerful. So I'm very inspired by that.
Mark, your stories, you kind of pull from life. I mean, do you have any of these experiences that you've gone through? You're like, you know what? This is amazing. Let me incorporate this into this book, or maybe a life lesson that you learned. You're like, okay, this is a character.
Absolutely. Following up on the previous point, I have two sons. They are 22 and almost 25. Two boys, no girls. I really respect, you know, raising a quality human being who's going to contribute to society is the most important thing you're going to do. I raised my sons to respect everybody. And it's so critical, especially these days. There's so much, you know, we need quality people out there. You know, we need the best people we can possibly make.
How do you raise quality people, Mark? That's interesting. Like, how do you raise them quality?
It's very, you know, the fundamentals. I mean, be polite, you know, be respectful. I mean, listen, you know, listen when you're spoken to. The greatest thing I hear is that your sons are so polite. They're so, you know, they'll help people carry groceries in family situations. And they're like, they're just so nice. I'm like, well, they better be, because that's I spend a lot of time, you know, making them as good a people as I can. And I'm proud of where they are. As far as my stories, my main character, Oscar Jade, is he's a private detective, but he's a former police officer. He was born with one club foot, so he has a physical disability, and he suffers from chronic pain. So every day for him is a challenge, and it gives him a perspective on how he helps people. He helps people with problems, the most important thing is just that he's a man of action. I've been asked, is he my alter ego? Well, I can't say that, but I envy his decisiveness. I envy his lack of fear, you know, and I think we can all aspire to that.
Mm-hmm. Mark, go ahead, Charlie.
Did you base that on someone you knew, that character, or what made you?
Well, actually, my brother, my brother was born with two club feet. Here comes my... hoping I could get through the whole show. My brother was born with club feet, and his disability definitely informed my character.
Very interesting. Okay, so we got the dogs barking. We heard
you. The door. I'll be right
okay.
back.
Okay, so we're going to go over to Peter. Peter, you're listening to the conversation. Everyone's sharing their stories about family and children. And what are your thoughts, Peter?
Well, I don't have children. I mean, I have two adopted kids that are out in Cambodia at the moment. I adopted them about eight years ago when I went there. They're 10 and 12, trying to give them a better life than were essentially given at birth. I'm trying to put them through school. I unfortunately don't get to see them, you know, that often, especially here in the last 7 months. I do get to speak to them every morning via, you know, Messenger or via Facebook. so I don't have quite the same, I guess, parenting as the rest of you guys, but I certainly hope that I'm able to, you know, to raise them as good as I can, you know, being as far away as I am. It's a bit different. They're not quite, they don't get quite the same opportunities as kids here, education and things like that. So for the most part, they're, you know, it's different.
But that's still beautiful that you have adopted the children and that you speak to them every morning. And with the quarantine, no one has been able to travel as much as any of us want to. You know, it's opening up a little. I went to Seattle in September, and when I posted, I was at the airport, everybody commented like, Sharifa, be safe. Make sure. I'm like, oh my God. Like, they're thinking I'm going, you know, to a different world or something. I'm going from California to Washington, but, you know, we don't travel as much. Now, what we talked about earlier was the whole aspect Greg mentioned of the butts in the seat. You work with a lot of restaurants. What are you seeing, Peter, as far as how they're coming back from this tragedy?
Well, here in California, unfortunately, we're still very much shut down. So there's still no inside dining. It's only outside. I think that probably, and I don't mean to be, you know, ignorant or anything, but it's probably one of the hardest industries hit, because they're really struggling. And right now we've been in being able to enjoy outdoor seating, and it's not something that Californians, you know, really necessarily enjoyed prior to, but something that we've somewhat, you know, been forced to, you know, accept. My big worry is that, you know, they've been able to somewhat survive in the last 3-4 months, you know, after the you know, the major lockdown. The big question is how will they really survive in the next coming months, because, you know, rain season starts, you know, it's getting much, much cooler outside. here in the West Coast, probably more so than in many other countries or in many other states, it's possible to sit outside all year round. But I'm wondering, you know, what do restaurants do, for example, on the East Coast? You know, it must be extremely hard. There's very few restaurants that are large enough that can have international markets. But even if you are an international, I mean, you know, even in Asia, even if you are in Europe, I mean, at the end of the day, how much of your total business or how much of your total revenue really come from those territories? At the end of the day, America's, you know, for most of the larger restaurants, that's their main territory. I Greg, think it's hard.
Yes, Greg, I would love your thoughts on that answer.
Yeah, no, I echo what Peter says. It's incredibly difficult for many, many businesses, restaurants included. I think, you know, if some of the smaller operations that don't really have the resources that were kind of living on a bit of a shoestring to begin with are definitely in peril. You know, some of the larger outfits that have a little bit more, you know, cash solvent and they can kind of get through or have large outdoor spaces available to them. One of my restaurant partners is 70% outdoors on a lake, and it's, you know, all the other restaurants in town are closed down, so they're all going there. So they're actually benefiting. And another one of my partners is really set up very well for takeout and delivery and that type of thing. So they're doing okay. But not every operation has the same, you know, benefit. If you're not set up and you're not kind of already in that position, it's tough. It's tough, especially going into the cooler months. You know, as Peter said, in some of these states that, you know, don't have the benefit of sunshine all year round, it's going to be a hard winter.
Yes. 2020 has definitely pushed all entrepreneurs. You know, we're having to come up with new ways to do business, restaurants particularly having to really put an emphasis on pickup, curbside, takeout, expanding their outdoor areas. So if nothing else, we've all learned from 2020 that we have to come up with these alternate ways of doing things. Even my gym, we're doing virtual sessions. So I think any business will take this moving forward, because no one will see the next pandemic. We don't know. So we've got to make it a part of our ongoing business model from now on.
Yeah. And Charlene, you'd probably agree too. I mean, it's the upside of all of this is that it's really forced entrepreneurs to kind of think outside of the box and come up with creative solutions, right? So there's probably a positive in there too, wouldn't you say?
I absolutely say so. You know, being an entrepreneur, you have to be resilient. You have to fail a lot before you succeed. And this is just something like a wake-up call for all of us that we need to keep innovating when we're an entrepreneur, definitely.
I totally agree with that in a sense that, you know, young people and young entrepreneurs, they, you know, they should rise, and they will rise to the task. My biggest concern is not necessarily those people, because, you know, again, they will rise. My bigger concern are the people that are in their, you know, in their 60s or even mid 60s or even in their 50s that have had that have had their business for years and years and years, and they have a good, you know, family business that, you know, that's providing jobs for, you know, 5, 10, you know, 50, 100 people. They're just not, you know, kind of out of the box. You know, they're having a little bit hard time, you know, working computers. They're having a little bit hard time understanding, you know, the whole kind of new wave of doing businesses. You know, those are the ones, you know, that are having a really, really, really hard time. And yes, the young people, I'm not worried about them. And I don't mean to say they're old, but, you know, the little bit older in a sense, you know, they're having a really, really hard time, which is essentially really unfair.
Yes, I agree with you. I also feel that what I've seen in speaking to so many business owners, entrepreneurs over this last 6 months is that there was really a clear divide. There were people who either became very, very successful during this time frame, or there were people who just went out of business, closed down and suffered. Like, as we all talk about Zoom, Zoom stock went up about 600-700%. And even with me, I know for a fact, I believe this to be true, is that if not for the time that we were in, I would have never had 5 guests per day show up for a talk show. Because prior to this, especially like Peter mentioned, your people who are 50, 60 years old, they're like, I only do offline meetings. I only go meet with people. I don't talk on a computer. I don't do any of that Zoom stuff. I don't know how it works. And then all of a sudden, a global pandemic, everybody's figuring out how it works because they have no choice. They have no alternative. So we have adjusted and pivoted as a people. I remember one guest in particular who does real estate, and we were talking about how he survived. And he said, Sharifa, he said, I have made more during this time frame. He said, because I actually took more meetings and showed more houses, because he was showing the houses virtually. He didn't have to go out and meet with this person and that person and wait for that person to arrive. And it was just, here's the house. You like what you see, you want to buy it. So he made more money.
So I just want to share that experience, that I'm actually one of those people that were hit by COVID. I am a parallelpreneur. So I am trying to launch my business while I work for government. Being a single mom and seeing the kids through, I had to prioritize being in a job to make sure that I do it. I didn't have any other way. And what I have found is I've been using Zoom, but it's just so overwhelming to start now conceiving the business online, as mm-hmm. opposed to, I was going to go to South Africa and have a conference where I have contact with moms, because I'm a contact person. And so where I live, it's actually fortunate that I could connect to Zoom today. It's not always that I'll be able to connect. So if I'm to pivot, as people say, pivot, like get the conference in a summit on Zoom and do that. Yes, I know it's possible, but right now physically where I am, of which I can't just move to maybe say Montreal or Toronto, where that would be better, but having to adjust to say, okay, this is how I saw 2021, but it's not going to happen as I had planned. And I'm in between. I'm still assessing whether I'll be safe enough money-wise to leave my job and then really focus on what I'm trying to launch, which is my coaching and consulting business, among other gifts that I have. So just to share, I don't have a question.
I think those are beautiful gifts. And the first thing I would do is, you are doing it. You are making it happen. You are not trying. And just like Greg and Peter, they're on this show. Francie, Charlene is like, I can see she's over there rocking. She's like, I can help you. Let's work together. Let's do this. You know what I mean? And that's what we've done during this pandemic that I am so proud of, is that we've all kind of just grabbed hands and said, look, let me help you. Let me help you. Charlene, I saw you over there. I saw you.
Yes, you can totally do it. And I'm with you about the day job. You know, we always recommend you start as your side hustle going for as long as you can before you jump off and you feel financially secure. And that's important. So keep doing your side hustle. But I know that you can pivot and make it happen. So many people have profited from the pandemic, and it's all a variety of people. So if you have the will and the way, it's just about, like we said, adjusting your mindset and making it happen. But there's nothing wrong with keeping it a side hustle for a while until you completely get it going more strong.
Thanks, Charlene. I will be in touch, definitely.
Okay. Franzi, it's true. It took me about 3 years to launch my business, and I was doing it as a side hustle the whole time. And it was exhausting at times. And a lot of times I thought, it's never going to happen, you know? A lot of doubt there, but it's possible. I know you can do it too.
In those, thank you, Greg.
Yeah, the COVID era has been very difficult. I mean, you know, in terms of talking about your book, I like to do book signings. I like, you know, where actual living people walk up to you and you shake their hand and, you know, you chat with them a little bit, you get to know them, and all of that is gone. And so we've all had to adapt as best we can. I've got family in Florida, family in California. I learned to use Zoom very early in the pandemic. That's the only way I was able to talk to my extended family.
Did you do any virtual book signings?
I haven't yet, but I'm going to. I'm going to look into that.
Yes, I would do a virtual book signing. I've been able to do just about everything virtually. And actually, I fell in love with these teleconferences. I did one in October 9th and 10th, and December 29th and December 30th, I'm having the New Year, New You 2-day teleconference where I have presenters come in and do all these presentations on how to be a better you in the new year. And it's all virtual. It's so much that you can do virtual to the point where, you know, all my friends are concerned about me. They call, they're like, Sharifa, are you ever going to leave the house? And I always say, to go where? Like, we're in a global pandemic. Where is it you want me to go? I enjoy my life. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Charlene, is it just me?
I agree. Same thing. I just bought a whole bunch of new office furniture so I could camp out, feel happier, have a little more luxurious surroundings. I love it. I think there is a downside with the book signings, but then we can do a lot of events now and we can be in two different cities at once virtually that we couldn't have done or would have been exhausting. So I think there's a lot of potential, and I think we'll continue to see virtual events, virtual meetings really become that dominant or stay dominant moving forward, because it's saving money ultimately for a lot of us.
Money, time, and energy. Greg, do you do any virtual aspect of with your business?
In the beginning of the pandemic, I got a group of restaurateurs together to start, you know, talking, having conversation about COVID and what it means in our industry and how we can support each other, through it, especially in the beginning when so much was unknown and we were all just kind of shaking in our boots and trying to figure out what was going on. So just to be able, you know, as Charlene said, you know, to be able to come together and all these different restaurateurs from different states and different markets to come together and share resources and share ideas on what we think our best practices were going to be moving forward was incredibly helpful. And it was really just at our fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say more millionaires are made during a recession than any other point in time in history, because you need to figure it out. So all of a sudden, you know, when people are on the status quo, it's like everything's fine. Then the world goes to hell in a handbasket. It's like, okay, what do we do? And you have people getting together and coming up with ideas, because that's what we need to survive, is ideas. And I've seen people be so creative, not only creative in how they're operating their business, but I remember one guest who talked about she saw someone who passed out a letter in her neighborhood, and she told everyone in the neighborhood on this letter, if you need help or you need assistance, call me. So she's like, you know what, I'm gonna do the same thing. So she did it, put it out around her neighborhood, especially all the senior citizens. And she said, you know what? I didn't get one phone call that said, I need help with anything. She said, but I did get several phone calls with people say, hey, I never knew you were my neighbor. I didn't know who you are. Thank you for introducing yourself. So I think as a people, we've come a long way and we're helping each other get through this time frame. Now we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience and to everyone who is watching the show live and in the archives, and let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And we're going to start with you, Mark.
Well, what I hope is that people who are interested in just having a good time will pick up my book. This is my other one, my most current one. It's called Stormmaker. My website is marktheauthor.net. I am on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, digital, paperback. Please give me a look. And I appreciate your time. It's been so great meeting all you guys. I'm in awe of all of you.
Well, thank you. I'm in awe of you, Mark. And I'm going to look out for more of your work. Peter, what do you have for us?
Well, basically, number one, that, you know, I think at the end, you know, everything will be okay. We will get through this. We got through it, you know, 9/11 happened, and it was a little bit of a mess after that. 2009, when the financial crash happened, and we got through that. And, you know, 2020, and we will get through that as well. I have a little saying at the end of my my email that says, at the end, everything will be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not yet the end. So just remember that. And, you know, at the end, we'll be standing, we'll be okay.
That is beautiful. One of my favorite expressions. Thank you for sharing that, Peter. Greg, what do you have for us?
Well, I just want to say a quick thank you to you, Sharifa, for doing this. I think this is a really important way for people to come together and share ideas. It's a great platform. And I love, you know, everybody from different walks and different areas. And we all have a lot in common, I think. And I just want to say thank you to everybody for being here. Been inspired by each and every one of you. And I think I just hope the viewers take away something from this collaboration more than anything.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I appreciate you. Charlene, what do you have for us?
It has been wonderful, Sharifa. And at first I was a little nervous about not knowing what the format was, I have to admit, but this has turned out great. And it's been a really engaging conversation. I've really enjoyed learning about everyone. And I would like to tell anyone who's watching, thank you for taking the time to listen to us and to hear what we have to say. And I want everyone to know that no matter what happens to you, like many of the other panelists have said, it's all going to be okay. You can do also whatever you want in life. Just put your mind to it. And if you're interested in checking out my new book, I would not mind that. It's called Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. I think everyone's a little nervous. That's what I take great pride in. Like, just everyone's nervous. It's like, this is going to be fun because I have no idea how the conversation is going to go. But somehow, some way, we always find the commonalities. Francie, what do you have for us?
Yeah, I'll speak from a coach's perspective that we desire change, or if we are dissatisfied about something, we can always do something about it. So we create a vision of what we want, right? What do we want to see as a result of this dissatisfaction? What do we want to see? Let's have that vision. And then that vision is not enough to create and just look at it. Maybe it's a vision, but it's not enough. What do we need to do? We need to take the first step. So without the first step, we don't get anywhere. But having taken the first step, we have to realize when we multiply our vision times our first steps, is it big enough? Is it bigger than our resistance to change? What is our resistance to change? So let's have a vision. Let's take the first step and make sure that whatever it is that deters us from moving forward, let's work towards making our vision so big, our first step so big that nothing will stop us. There's no resistance. And then we will find the change that we are looking for. So yeah, thank you for this platform. Thank you for these wonderful people that I met today because of you, Sharifa. God bless you.
You are so welcome. God bless you as well. And I can tell you right now, you have a message that the world needs to hear. So it may seem daunting. Like Greg said, he was doing it for 3 years. I built my first website in 1994. I've been doing this for over 25 years. So we always expect things to happen immediately or overnight. But if you keep going, you keep walking, you definitely have a powerful message. I want to thank all of you for being a guest on today's episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. And I definitely want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch this show live, as well as everyone who is watching it in the archives. Just because you didn't catch the live show doesn't mean you are not still important. And we still need your support. So please go ahead and share the show. And also visit our guests. Their information, their website is in the Facebook post. Check them out. Follow them on social media, send them a message. And when you connect, please let them know Sharifa Hardy says hi. Now, if you're interested in more ways that I can help your business, maybe you want to pick up your tickets to my the new year, new you, two-day teleconference, or maybe you want to be a guest on the Roundtable Talk Show, please visit my website at asharifa.com. Until tomorrow morning at the same time, the same place, everyone have a blessed day. Bye now.